Good afternoon. You're listening to Curated, a weekly roundup of the who's who and the what's what in the arts and culture scene here in the Roaring Fork Valley. I'm Patrick Fort, Aspen Public Radio's arts and culture reporter. Each week, we bring you conversations and stories about notable happenings in our little slice of the world. Today on Curated, Governor John Hickenlooper.
You know, I ran for office to try and get people to believe in government again.
We go inside the Plein Air Festival.
Well, I'm trying to do a nice painting of the White House restaurant.
We hear from author Helen Schulman, and we explore the Snowmass concert series.
This doesn't seem real. This looks like a backdrop. It's a fantasy, and it's amazing. This feels like home to me.
All of that, plus our song of the week, and as always, the week in the arts. A quick rundown of the top things to see, hear, and experience this week in the Valley. That's all coming up on Curated from Aspen Public Radio News. Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper released his memoir, The Opposite of Woe, My Life in Beer and Politics, earlier this year. He appeared in Aspen last week to sign his book, and I spoke to him before the event.
John, the first thing I want to ask you is why write this memoir now? It's been a few months since it came out, but why now?
Well, you make that decision about a year and a half ago, because it takes a while to write these darn things. Mm-hmm. My dad died when I was 8, and it bothered me. He was a great storyteller, lived a life full of adventure, died very young. He died when he was 40. And I never knew most of his stories. It was my mother's second husband who died. So we grew up kind of in a sad household. We didn't tell a lot of those stories. And I always wanted to collect a bunch of my stories for my son, Teddy, who is 14 now. And, about a year and a half ago, my speechwriter, Max Potter, said, I'm probably going to go on and do something else. And if you ever wanted to write it, you've talked about collecting stories for your son for a long time. If you ever wanted to put that book together, I'd love to ghostwrite it. And this is a good point for me to do it. Probably the only time I'll have a block of time like this. And I bet we could sell it to a publisher.
You get very, very intimate in this book. Like you say, you include lots of things that probably would not look good in a so-called political interview, I guess. And I want to know why that was important for you to do.
Well, part of the reason I got into politics, a big part, was that, the public is so unhappy with elected officials, so dissatisfied. Every city council member, every congressperson, every mayor is a bum. And, I kept saying to my customers when I was in the restaurant business, if you want to criticize these folks, this is America. They are us. And you should run for office. And somehow my customers turned that against me. But I ran for office to try and get people to believe in government again. And most of the biographies that elected officials write are sanitized. They do look like job interviews for higher office, full of messaging and only the good things, nothing, no mistakes or dumb things you did when you were young. I wanted to be different. I wanted people to, even if it worked against me in terms of establishing my identity on a larger platform, I wanted it to be authentic. I wanted to ring true to people that this was someone, telling their story, warts and all.
Now, the title, the primary title, The Opposite of Woe, I want to know where that came from and if that came before the book or after.
No, the opposite of woe, it was a clipping. When I was first running for mayor and I was behind in the polls, and it's funny, I had these young volunteers, and I needed to kind of fire them up. And so this clipping was about a professor of public speaking at the University of Wyoming up in Laramie. And she was asking her class, or explaining to them how important it was to use opposites in the same sentence if you want to create emotional impact. She said, you know, if you talk about the agony, talk about the ecstasy. If you're going to talk about the worst of times, talk about the best of times. She asked, what's the opposite of despair? A kid raised their hand and goes, joy. She goes, exactly. You want people to feel despair, use joy in the same sentence. Then she said, she put her hand on her forehead and she said, what's the opposite of woe? And a kid way in the back goes, giddy up. And, you know, I mean, it's a funny joke, but really, in many ways, the opposite of woe is to giddy up. And, mm-hmm. and in some very powerful ways, my mom was widowed twice, you know, within the space of about 15 years. She raised four kids by herself. And I think she understood what the opposite of woe was. You don't sit and feel sorry for yourself. You keep working. You figure out a way to make the best out of any situation. And by working hard enough, you get yourself into a new situation, a better situation, which she did. Again, repeatedly in her life. So I guess the opposite of woe is kind of I meant it to be kind of inspirational to the nerds and geeks in life. You know, the kids like me who grew up with acne and thick glasses and were skinny, didn't really ever go on dates until they were well into college. You know, just because you go through some hard periods in your life doesn't mean that if you're willing to work at it and be persistent, you can do pretty much anything you want in this country.
Now, there's this official kind of metric that we think about with presidents specifically. Kind of you vote for the one that you would want to have a beer with, right? And as a brewer and now a politician, I want to know what politician you would want to have a beer with.
Well, it's funny because I'm not sure I use that metric as a great...
sure.
...as a great choice of... who I'd want to vote for. Certainly, I think there's some of the people I've had a lot of beers with, right? Mm-hmm. Michael Bennett, our U.S. Senator from Colorado. He was my chief of staff for a couple of years. And he's a great person to have a beer with. Mark Warner, another U.S. Senator from Virginia, I think is a fabulous person to have a beer with. Cory Gardner, other U.S. Senator from Colorado, but Cory Booker from Senator from New Jersey. And, you know, I have had a beer with Barack Obama. And, you know, we were playing pool when I was running for re-election in 2014. And he is a great person to have a beer with. I can say it firsthand.
And like, what about those people make them great to have a beer with?
Well, obviously, anytime you're having beers with anyone, or even a glass of wine, you know, it's about conversation. And conversation, right, first and foremost, involves listening. And, you know, everyone I just mentioned is a good listener, and they've lived unusual, intriguing lives, but they also listen. So it's never a sermon. It's you know, it's a conversation.
One thing I think is interesting about you in your book is there's this one thing I've kind of observed is that you kind of represent what I think of as like the new Colorado. It's kind of, I think there's this perception still that people are slowly starting to lose that Colorado is, you know, primary, it's like ranching and cows and all that stuff. But, you know, we have all the tech sector, obviously brewing is a large industry. And I feel like you're one politician person who kind of embodies that new aesthetic of Colorado. I want to know what you think of that, or if I'm crazy, maybe.
Well, I don't know. I mean, in a funny way, I'm brewing, but I'm brew pubs. I'm craft beer. You know, the idea that people would pay more for a beer of higher quality, more distinctive, and enjoy it more and drink less. I mean, it's a different business model in many ways. I think that Colorado still has a strong blend of conservative and liberal. And, you know, most people, I'm very liberal socially, but pretty conservative fiscally. So in a funny way, I'm kind of a representation of the old Colorado as well. I have had more interface with the new technology industries, and, you know, I get a lot of credit for the renaissance of lower downtown, probably more than I deserve, and that, you know, that renaissance is kind of the new Colorado, right? Taking an old abandoned warehouse district and making it into a vibrant urban area with light rail and a multimodal transportation hub in Union Station. That is kind of, you know, symbolic of the new Colorado. But I'm also, you know, about, you know, grinding it out and you know, trying to make sure we have enough water and enough water storage. Coloradans have been working on that for many decades. You know, a lot of the stuff we, you know, public education. How do we get more of our kids better prepared for the jobs of the future? Well, again, we haven't figured out the solution there. There's no giant disruptive innovation. We're grinding it out. So it's kind of a blend. I guess I'm a blend. I'm a hodgepodge. I'm a melting pot in myself.
All right, Governor John Hickenlooper, thanks very much for speaking with us today.
No, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
That was Governor John Hickenlooper speaking about his book, The Opposite of Woe, My Life in Beer and Politics. The Red Brick Center for the Arts Plein Air Festival closed over the weekend. I spoke to participating artists about why they like painting outside. It was kind of a sunny day on Tuesday. That's when Peter Campbell, a painter from Durango, had his homemade easel set up.
Well, I'm trying to do a nice painting of the White House restaurant.
Campbell is returning to the Red Brick Center for the Arts Plein Air Festival. Plein air is a French term, meaning in full or open air. That's the whole idea of the event, painting outside and recreating what you see. Campbell won first prize in the event last year, but it isn't a competition for him. His subject, the White House Tavern, is right in his wheelhouse.
I kind of like white. That's a fun thing to paint because it's never really white. It's always some other color, and so it's a challenge. And the architecture's a challenge, getting all the angles and things in their right places.
What happens if it rains, like it's kind of starting to right now?
Well, you notice how I'm just kind of ignoring it? Well, I looked over earlier and it didn't look like it was going to rain for very long, but this might get serious.
And as the clouds got darker, it started raining.
Let's get the umbrella noise. Here it is.
Campbell paints outdoors because he enjoys the challenges of changing light, weather, of course, and the journey to each location. Artists paint in multiple places during the week-long event. His easel collapses into a little box. He's currently prototyping it for sale because he likes the design so much. Later in the week, Aspenite Lee Shapiro is painting flowers outside the Red Brick Building while construction crews work across the street.
The patterns that they make are just really exciting. And then they're yellow flowers, but there's all kinds of reflected lights coming into them. There's cools and oranges, and so there's a lot of variety of hue.
It's his first time participating in the event. He says he was too busy doing other things, biking, paragliding. When you get into the flow of painting, he says, it doesn't matter what your subject is. This week's guest for First Draft is Helen Schulman, author of This Beautiful Life. The book tells the story of an upper-class family and how their lives change forever when 15-year-old Jake receives a sext from a younger girl. The novel touches on the issue of privacy, identity, parenthood, and morality. Schulman tells host Mitzi Rapkin about how she chose the topic of the novel.
There were a lot of things I was thinking about at that time. I lived through 9/11, and for all the horror of 9/11, as a New Yorker, and I guess even as an American, I was so incredibly moved by the way we came together in New York after the attacks. It was just incredible, and there was so much bravery, and I just felt like we had this chance to renew ourselves, and then I felt that that was all squandered by the Bush administration and by us. And so I was really interested in that post 9/11 society pre-crash. I was suddenly seeing intense wealth in a way that I'd never seen in my life. We have a middle-class family. I was very interested in that, this sort of rush to greed and this, the crazy money that came through the city. And, you know, now we see it everywhere. You know, for years, it was just sort of this crazy grab fest. And I was very interested in the sexualization of girls and women. My daughter's now 20, but when she was little, I was really super shocked by how sexy her friends were dressed. I remember the bat mitzvah year and how difficult it was for me to find her something pretty to wear that A, wasn't a fortune, and B, didn't make her look like, you know, a prostitute. I guess I'm a 70s feminist. That's when I came of age. And I was really, really shocked when my kids went to school and how many women there, women who had every choice in the world, just didn't work. And a lot of them had gone to the best schools and were super trained and really smart and really creative. And there was just all this brain power that wasn't going anywhere but into the home, and which, of course, nothing's more important than the home. And I'm certainly not saying what women should do. Women should do whatever they want. But it was just interesting seeing these really high-powered women not have a position of power and how that worked. So I was thinking about that. And then finally, it was the internet. I mean, it was just such an earthquake in our lives, and just the idea of privacy and the lack of it and the lack of control.
So yes, everything that you just mentioned is in the book. It's, you know, about this family of four and the son, Jake, who is a teenager, gets a sext from this younger girl. I believe she's in eighth grade, Daisy. And the book opens with sort of a description of the girl preparing and shooting this sext and then sending it. It's actually via the computer. And he forwards it without thinking. And that's sort of the inciting incident for the book and the family. So how did you distill all these things that you just explained to me into this moment and this story? Did it take a lot of background writing?
There were a couple of things that came my way. I mean, one, the first thing that actually happened was that somebody sent me, like, I guess it's a meme, I don't know, a photo of a woman who was a bridesmaid at a wedding wearing a strapless dress, reaching up for the bouquet, and her boobs popped out. And it came into my inbox. And I just crumpled up into a ball. I was like, this is so humiliating and so embarrassing. And if it happened to you in the past, your girlfriend would like turn you around and say nobody saw it, and you would drink two drinks and forget that it ever happened. But instead, it went to millions of people, including me, who didn't even know her. And I was so shocked by that. It was that whole idea of how fast things travel and how heartless they are. I mean, in a way, it's a funny thing maybe, but it's really not. So that happened. And then I had heard a story from a mother on the sidewalk who said, did you hear about this girl who took a video of herself and sent it to this boy? And I was like, what? You know, again, this is all back in the day at this point. So I was really shocked by all of it.
There are different points of view in your book about culpability and Jake's culpability. And what happens is he gets this. He had had an incident with this girl that night at the party where she wanted to make out and explore more than he wanted to. And he left, and she sent him this thing, basically asserting herself, saying, I'm old enough for you. And he just saw it, and he did have this moment of shock, and he didn't know what to do, and he just forwarded it. I mean, what were you thinking about culpability when you were writing this?
There was a point where I had to do a lot of work because I wasn't sure what tack to take. Should this be boys who are really exploiting a girl? Should this be a girl who was really, you know, a bad seed? And then I just decided, no, I'm going to make them both innocents. I think the girl is, you know, she's really been taught by her mother and her father and the culture around her that the way to get love is to be sexy and pretty. And she really wants this boy. She's a very lonely girl. And he says, you're too young. So as you said, she's going to prove it. I think he's a sweet boy. He's not ready for any of it. And it was a hot potato. I do see the kids as innocent. And I think the parents were in a terrible spot. I mean, yeah, we often are in terrible spots. It's how we handle them.
That was Helen Schulman, author of This Beautiful Life. She spoke with First Draft host Mitzi Rapkin. The Snowmass concert series ended last week. I attended a show to dive into one of the biggest cultural events of the summer. Several hundred people are sitting on Fannie Hill and Snowmass on a cool Saturday evening. The band Tartan Terrors is up on stage performing what they call Celtic rock, kilts included. It's the annual Colorado Scottish Festival, so it isn't just the band on stage wearing kilts. Men in the crowd walk around in the traditional outfit, the feathered hats, jackets, kilts, even those high socks. Not everyone is here for the festival, though. Brandy Garcia is visiting from Denver. She's been coming to Snowmass nearly every summer since she was a kid. Garcia says part of what makes the concerts so special is the landscape.
This doesn't seem real. This looks like a backdrop. It's a fantasy, and it's amazing. This feels like home to me.
Garcia is at the show with her mother. They're not singing along, just enjoying the music. At bigger shows, like Charlie Tuna and Jamestown Revival, the crowds are a bit more active, singing and dancing as the band plays. When you can't hear, though, it's hard to participate. A newer element of the concert series are the translators standing in front of the stage, putting the music into American Sign Language. Lisa Thomas is the executive director of the Aspen Camp for the Deaf and Hard of Hearing.
We actually do a lot of preparation before the event, about a week's worth of preparation by listening to their music, downloading the lyrics, reviewing how you would translate that into American Sign Language.
Thomas and her colleagues started signing at the concerts 3 years ago. And all of that work that she's talking about, that's not how it was done when the translations were just getting going. It was just a few people who had worked for nearly a dozen weeks over the summer to make the concerts more accessible. The first year, things were a little rough.
We just sort of went and did it, maybe a day, maybe the day before.
Now there's a lot more work that goes on ahead of time. There's a week of preparation for each concert. Issues they have to work out, trying to get the timing right so their signs match up to the lyrics or keeping their energy up. Thomas says the performance by rapper Charlie Tuna was especially difficult. He just doesn't stop, she says. One advantage some of her fellow translators have is the ability to remember lyrics right away.
I'm not one of them. I really have to practice at it.
And another challenge, how do you sign words like supercalifragilisticexpialidocious or other unreal words?
I sometimes will just sign these are made up words that have no meaning.
There are two translators at each concert. They switch in and out after 30 minutes or so. That's because they get tired. The way the translators experience the show doesn't differ much from how the audience takes it all in. Of course, except for the fact that they're performing too. Sometimes, Thomas says, the translators will become a bigger part of the show than they'd planned.
The community was watching the interpreter, and the band was talking to the interpreter and including the interpreter in conversation and kind of making fun of the interpreter, which is fun, and seeing how fast the interpreter could go. And the audience really came up and said, you know, it was fun and we enjoyed it.
Brandy Garcia loves the raucous concerts on Thursday nights on her vacations. She also loves the different sort of environment she can experience when she's not just listening to the music.
Because you can't beat the setting. You can just, like, sit here, watch, like, the band play, hear amazing music, but you're in the most amazing setting ever.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Curated. For this week's Song of the Week, we've gone with a very new release. 2 days ago, Bon Iver put out two tracks from his really highly anticipated new album, which comes out at the end of September. This song is called 22 Over Soon.
It might be over soon.
Monday, August 15th, and this is the Week in the Arts, an abbreviated list of the upcoming events and happenings in the Valley. The Aspen Santa Fe Ballet performs on Tuesday at the Aspen District Theater. The Basalt Public Library will screen Some Like It Hot on Wednesday. Dirty Heads play at the Belly Up in Aspen on Wednesday as well. Artist Hank Willis Thomas speaks at the Aspen Art Museum on Thursday. Maraca and his Latin All-Stars perform at the JAS Cafe at the Little Nail on Friday. Friday is also the last day of the Aspen Music Festival and School. Shakespeare in the Park starts on Friday. The Zope Family Circus performs in Snowmass all weekend. Theater Aspen's Buyer and Seller closes on Friday, and Mamma Mia closes on Saturday. Andrew Bird performs at the Belly Up in Aspen. Music on the Mountain starts in Glenwood Springs on Saturday. This is Curated, a weekly roundup dedicated to arts and culture. I'm Patrick Fort at the Ed Lisneason Arts and Culture Desk. Curated is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.